This is Table for Three, a podcast of the Green Duck Lounge Project. I'm playwright Michelle Tyrene Johnson. In Table for Three, we're talking about Missouri's civil rights history, current activism in the state, and issues raised in the production of the Green Duck Lounge. Today, we're talking about Kansas City, the home of the actual Green Duck Lounge, and its history as the birthplace of Freedom, Inc., one of the most influential civil rights organizations in the country. Joining me at today's table is Glenn Rice. Glenn is a journalist with the Kansas City Star who worked with investigative reporter Mike McGraw to investigate the unsolved assassination of Kansas City civil rights organizer Leon Jordan. The reporting and the activism of Leon Jordan at the Green Duck Lounge inspired the play. Also here with me at the table is Dr. Micah Kubik. Micah is the executive director of the ACLU of Kansas, and he's the author of Freedom, Inc. and Black Political Empowerment. He's a historical advisor on the production of the Green Duck Lounge Project. Thanks, Micah and Glenn, for joining me here today.
Thanks for having us.
So, Freedom, Inc. is such an institution in Kansas City. I mean, I know I've heard about it my entire life as a Kansas City native. I'll start with you, Glenn. What do you think is so particularly different about Freedom, Inc. as a political organization?
It would be its origins and how it rose from the Kansas City's small but fledgling black community into a political powerhouse that had influence throughout the state and even stretched to Washington, D.C., for that matter. And it has been the blueprint of how other political organizations, including those in St. Louis and elsewhere, were to grow and to develop. The interesting thing is, at the time of the origin of Freedom, Inc., the powers in the black community had been dominated by the North End or outsiders, for that matter. They were able to pick and choose whomever they wanted to serve in political office. But when Freedom came around, it felt the need to empower those people within that community, and Leon Jordan was a cornerstone of that organization.
Michael, what do you think? What is it about Freedom, Inc. that provided the secret sauce, so to speak, to the political climate of Kansas City?
So I think Freedom, Inc. was really successful at building a structure, building an organization, building an institution. And that's something that doesn't happen all that often, right? Especially in politics. What often happens is folks wind up getting really excited about one particular campaign or one particular candidate and devoting all of their energies to that. And even when that's successful, 2 or 4 or 6 or 8 years later, that energy is gone. And I think the founders of Freedom, Inc. were really deliberate about trying to build a grassroots base and making sure that even though there were folks within it who were really important and influential and well-respected, the Leon Jordans and Bruce Watkins of the world, it was never really just about them. It wasn't just about them as singular leaders. Instead, they were really building an organization over the long term. And I think that's why you see the organization continue to this day. You know, there were a bunch of similar groups that were founded around the country in the 1960s. And almost every one of them has closed the doors, turned out the lights, been gone for 20 years now. And Freedom, Inc. persists, maybe not at quite the same level of impact and influence that it once had, but is still around because there was that conscious effort to build an organization, to build a structure, to build deep ties to the community, especially in counterpoint to what Glenn was saying, in counterpoint to the folks in the North End or Louis Wagner, who lived on Ward Parkway but was in charge of wards in the black community during that time. You know, as a result, they were very conscious about not doing that.
Great.
And I think what happens today is Freedom does have a significant influence, and I think there was a period in which the second generation of the Freedom leaders would be Emanuel Cleavers, the Charles Hasleys, didn't necessarily groom their successors. And that's something that Emanuel Cleaver admitted to me years ago when he was mayor of Kansas City and transitioned to congressman. You had a period in which you had a number of elected officials, which was representative from the city council, for example. You had the growth of the Freedom, Inc. influence, not only from the 3rd and 5th districts in Kansas City, which is primarily in the east, north portion of the east side, and stretching all the way out to maybe Gregory Boulevard to the 6th District, when you had basically half of the council was African-American. And then segue a few years later, you only had maybe only a handful because they did not cultivate the next generation. That has changed now. So you do have a number of young African-American leaders in their 30s, if you will, early 40s, that are now gaining political power, who they felt the need to educate them, really took more of a classroom approach towards educating the next generation of political leaders. So when they ran for city council, when they ran for the school board, for state office, they knew what they were getting, what they were doing, and had some sense of what their role and responsibilities would have been or would be in that case. So, and one thing I kind of wanted to mention that at the time of his murder, Leon Jordan was, they were wrestling with that next generation of leadership. He was running for another term in the Missouri House, and he was being challenged by a young, up-and-coming community activist, if you will, Lee Bohannon, who was from Arkansas, became into power, if you were, influenced by his role in the riots of 68. And he was just a guy who worked at Attention Envelope, was taking his brothers and sisters to school. They saw some kids protesting from Paseo. These kids wanted to join in on it. See, what he did was try to organize them, to make sure they wouldn't run in the street and so forth. So, you know, and so what happened was Lee decided to run for Leon's seat because he felt that, well, it's time for you to move on. And Leon had actually thought about, you know, stepping aside and doing that, but he decided to hold on to that seat because he was getting up in age and had other interests and things that he wanted to do. So,
okay. Well, you brought up the 68 riots, Glenn, and actually Mike and I were talking about that. We were talking about how people have a tendency to think of Kansas City as a more passive city in terms of it being low-key, while forgetting the past, while forgetting that in 68 we did have riots. Could you tell us, Mike, a little bit your view of what we were talking about in terms of that influence on the climate at the time of when Leon Jordan was around?
Sure. So people forget that there was an urban rebellion in Kansas City in 1968, immediately in the aftermath of the assassination of Dr. King. So Kansas City is a little bit unique in that the urban rebellion that happens here is later than it is in other parts of the country. You know, Watts happens 4 years earlier. Most of the 60s are known for these long, hot summers. That's what they called them, right, where there were rebellions, multiple rebellions in multiple cities. And Kansas City didn't have one until 1968. And even then, frankly, it probably might have been avoided if law enforcement had not reacted to some of the peaceful protests that was happening in the days after Dr. King's assassination the way that they did. So, for example, there were no riots in Kansas City, Kansas, on the other side of the state line, because there, the school district and the city made the conscious decision to let school out. There was no school on the day of Dr. King's funeral. Kansas City, Missouri schools chose not to do that. Instead, made people come to school and then were surprised when there was when there were protests, for example, on the lawn at Lincoln High School. And the big sort of violence unfurled when there was a dance that was scheduled in a church, consciously to try and avoid having unrest, right? The dance was organized so that kids would have a place to go where they would feel safe and not be out on the streets. And Lee Bohannon was part of that. And police came by and decided that they saw someone doing something that they thought they shouldn't be. And rather than investigating it, they threw canisters of tear gas through the basement window of this church where the dance was happening. And unsurprisingly, that didn't go well, right? People were not happy about that. It set things off in a way that probably wouldn't have if that incident hadn't happened. And that's when you had unrest ensue. And there were several days of tension and violence. There were interactions in the urban core, businesses destroyed. I think something like $10 million worth of damage happens. And one of the things that's really interesting to me and that I think about in the context of our current political environment is that you even had white folks from outside of the city come into the city and do sharpshooting from roofs against police officers in the hope that African Americans in the community would be blamed and that there would be an even more violent backlash against it.
You mean there was actually intrusion by some people outside of a community to incite the community? That's almost right. like the news today, right?
False flag. We hear lots about false flag conspiracy theories now. Well, then it wasn't a conspiracy theory. It was real.
Yeah, right? Another interesting thing that happened, too, considering in today's climate, is the consciousness, political consciousness or social consciousness of professional athletes. Believe it or not, there were some Kansas City Chiefs that kind of took to the airways. In particular, Fred the Hammer Williamson, who was still playing for the Chiefs, had went to the airways and went on radio, I think maybe Quickie or maybe KPRS. KPRT was trying to say, hey, brothers and sisters, calm down. We know you're angry. You know you're upset. So guys like he, Otis Taylor, Buck Buchanan, Willie Lanier, they actually walked the streets to try to really calm folks down. So, So that's interesting within a country because the Chiefs have so much influence, and so you know they try to be present themselves as a calming influence during a very turbulent time. So I reported, I think every 25 years or so, report the history of the riots and talk to some of the cops that were involved with it, and it's kind of interesting. So this year would be the 50th anniversary.
Yes, I was going to mention that. This is the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and with all the stories and all the attention that's going to be paid to that. And you know, one of the points of my play is just to show that things are a mirror of what has happened, that there's really nothing new under the sun in terms of activism or what's happened or what people talk about. Which that reminds me of something else I wanted to ask each of you. Each of you have covered Leon Jordan from very different angles. You as a journalist, Glenn, you as a historian, Micah. Do you have any aspects of Leon Jordan, of the whole Freedom Inc. era, basically, of that time, that people don't know about that would be particularly interesting and insightful and enlightening?
Aside from electing political leaders, they also played a major role in the public accommodations referendum that was put before voters. And it had not been for Freedom, Leon Jordan, his influence, getting people, and particularly like-minded whites and other groups, to vote in support of that, you would have not had the public accommodations, equal access, and so forth, to what you may have today. And aside from electing leaders, they also kind of provided a base, if you will, that saw the rise of a lot of things. The results of the rise itself was the city human relations department. Studies about how things could be improved from a race relations standpoint in Kansas City. The city's human relations department is still functioning. So that, believe it or not, Leon Jordan, his work, what they did, laid the foundation for a lot of things that you have today. So. And even with the increase of African Americans and other minorities in public service jobs, with government jobs and so forth, you know, you walk to City Hall right now, and the county, it's a significant number of African Americans and other minorities with jobs. At one point, that was almost unheard of. So,
Mike, as a historian, what sort of things could anything in particular you want to share that you found interesting, insightful, new, surprising?
So I think one of the things that I hear a lot in the activism that I do now is that we would be farther along on civil rights and the quest for freedom and justice if there were more unity, right? There's all this tension in the community. Folks don't always get along, don't always agree, that there's not enough unity within the African-American community. And then the second part of that is folks usually say, if it were the way it was back then, in the 1960s, in this sort of imagined version of the 1960s, then we would be much better off. But I think if you go back and look at the actual historical record, there was just as much, if not more, tension and friction in the black community in Kansas City in the 1960s than there is today. I think we look back with sort of rose-colored glasses now and think that because we have a high estimation of Leon Jordan and view him as this completely unifying figure whom everyone always loved and agreed with, that it was that way then, and that's just not true. It's true he was respected. It's true that he was generally well-liked. But that doesn't mean that even folks who respected and liked him agreed with him all the time, or that there wasn't a whole lot of dissent or disagreement or infighting. And yet folks still managed to get stuff done. And so I think the lesson for us today is that we should actually listen to what they said back then, which is unity without uniformity, right? That you can be united without always agreeing 100% of the time, and use what we've got now in order to make progress, rather than seeking and grasping after this imaginary, complete, total uniformity that's never going to happen and probably shouldn't even if it could.
And I actually think if you want to draw a parallel is what you find in the late fascists of the civil rights movement in 68 with the rise of the Black Power, Stokely Carmichael. You saw that although they were protesting and marching with King, particularly in Selma, they didn't agree. And so they had different approaches. Eventually, King kind of came around to a certain degree. But, like you mentioned, there was a lot of friction. And I think once you mentioned, I began to think about a lot of that. You had Lee Bohannon, other side, you had Bernard Powell.
Emmanuel Cleaver, right?
Yeah,
who was very frankly opposed to Freedom Incorporated for the first couple of times he ran for office and only later sort of reconciled and then obviously became an integral part of it. Mm-hmm. But in 1969, 1970.
When he came to hit Kansas City to run the YMCA, and he was.
Yeah. And the SCLC.
SCLC, which totally, obviously you have CORE, which is more the middle class integrated, more than you had, you had SAC 20, mm-hmm.
yeah. I'm loving this conversation between the two of you.
I'm dying to read his book.
I know, right? You guys, your combined knowledge and history of Kansas City puts me to shame, and it's just, and it's great, and it's what I was hoping to do with this podcast, because people need to know not just about our current realities in terms of activism and civil rights in Missouri, but its history, its lineage, what it came from. This is Table for Three. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson talking with Glenn Rice and Micah Kubik. We're talking about the history of civil rights and Black activism in Kansas City and beyond. To learn more about this podcast and the Green Duck Lounge, go to greenduckproject.com. So here's how I'd like to finish our last few minutes together. What do you both, I'll start with you, Mike, and then move over to Glenn. What do you think is missing from the conversation in Kansas City in particular about race and how we can address better some of the issues that still come up?
So I think we a lot of times have conversations about the need to have a conversation about race and never actually get to having the conversation about race. So I think that would be the big thing I would point out. And I think there are a lot of different issues where we would see how race is lived and experienced, but we never get to it. So, for example, voting rights. There is no more urgent civil rights issue in the country today, perhaps, than voting rights. And that's a darn shame, because it's something that we should have resolved and thought we had resolved in 1965 when people walked over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. But clearly we got to walk over some more bridges in our time, because voting rights are under attack today in a way that they haven't been in years. And that is something that is a direct outgrowth of racial injustice, right? If you look all around this country, every single new voting rights restriction we see disproportionately impacts African Americans and Latinos. And we don't really have that conversation. Instead, when we're talking about voting rights, what always happens is it winds up being a Democrat versus Republican sort of issue. And I frankly couldn't care less about that. I could not care less about which particular party wins in that battle, because that's not what it's about. It's about trying to exclude entire groups of people from citizenship and from basic humanity. And we never get to have that conversation. So I think that's what's missing. I think we have discussions about issues, and we have discussions about the need to have a conversation about race, but we never link those two together and actually have the conversation about the way racial injustice is lived every day.
I agree. Glenn?
I think there are some efforts towards that end that are being worked out. For example, the Church of I-10 has a partnership with the Church of the Resurrection over in Overland Park. They have racial allies for justice, I've got the exact, please forgive me. But there are other groups that are like the churches coming together, sharing some cross-cultural relationships and being more deliberate about the issues of white privilege, issues of undercurrent racism. I think we just saw just this past week how ugly and toxic the issue of race or racism has been with the issue over and independence with the Applebee's, which is it's hard to even watch the video because you can feel the pain that this woman is experiencing being profiled the way that she was, you know, unnecessarily. So, and I do agree with the voting rights issue, how difficult it is and how certain factions or factors in this country are making it, even in the state, is making it more difficult. So,
you know, one of the things that we all probably agree in this room, in this building, probably in this city, is that Missouri keeps getting brought into the public light these last few years, between Ferguson, between what happened at MU, the frequent things that happen, like the Applebee's that you're talking about that come up. I mean, Missouri comes up a lot for it to be a state that is not in the traditional deep south of the United States. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I think you said before there's nothing new under the sun, right? Everything old is new. Well, this is the same thing that Missouri has always done, right? So during the Civil War, Missouri stayed part of the Union, but was still a place where slavery was legal, right? It was a state that couldn't make up its mind even then. During the Civil War, there was a rump group of state legislators who didn't agree to stay with the Union, so they went and started their own state capital down in Neosho instead and tried to pretend like the state was part of the Confederacy. So I think we have to acknowledge that history and say, you know, there's long historical memory. There's long historical memory. Even if we don't know that we know these things, they seep into the culture, they seep into our bones, and we live them as a result.
I can't add anything. He's right on point. I was going to say the same thing, but not as eloquent as he did. So
that's the thing too that I find that so many people, when I discuss racism with them today, is that they want to believe that racism is some relic from the past, as if one, it was that long ago, as if the basic institutional racism was so long ago. So many people want to jump back to slavery and forget about Jim Crow. And if we're talking about Jim Crow, I mean, it only ended the year I was born, and I'm not that old. So it makes it a difficult conversation. It makes it a really difficult conversation when people can't admit the starting point of the discussion.
It's an ongoing legacy of slavery, like Mike had mentioned.
I mean, it really is. What do you hope, each of you, hope to have come out of the discussions that will be generated by the play in terms of the talk back afterwards and just getting people to really maybe dig deep a little into the subject?
Well, I think there are two things that I would hope for. First, I would hope that people do have that sort of historical memory jogged in them, right? The recognition that what we are living through today, although it is difficult and challenging and frustrating, we're not the first people on earth to have this set of challenges and frustrations. The names are different. Some of the issues are, not all of the issues, but some of the issues are different. But the basic underlying tensions and frustrations are the same. People figured out a way to overcome them before. We can do so again. That's one. And the second one that I would hope for is that I love that the play is called The Green Duck Lounge, right? Because it's about a place. It's about something bigger than individual people. It's not called Leon's and Jimmy's, right? And there's a reason for that, because as important as Leon and Jimmy were, the Green Duck and the symbolism it has as a place for political discussion, for community discussion, for community building is bigger than either one of them. And I think if we're really going to make progress in this world, that's what we have to do. Focus on ways to build structures, to build communities, rather than only focusing on individuals, whether they be corporate folks or politicians or whoever. We have to stop valorizing individuals and focus more on building the structures that will carry us on.
I completely agree with you. Before we cut to Glenn, Mike McGraw, who just passed away, who was a dear friend of mine and who badgered me into writing this play in the sense that I did not know as much about Leon Jordan and our history as I should have. And when I started doing my research, I, like you, I decided that it's bigger than Leon Jordan, even though he was such a big part of this. Glenn, as someone who broke the story with Mick about tell us a little. You got to leave us with a little bit of that, because that was fascinating.
It's a great story.
Mick was working on various projects, and he always, we would see each other in the newsroom, he'd say, hey, you know, I want to write this, do the story on Leon Drew. I want to solve, you know, are you interested? I said, yeah, of course. Mick says he wants you to work on the story together. It only takes a second. You know, first of all, you know, you're shocked that he's asked you. And then secondly, you make sure what comes out of your mouth is an affirmative. So, and he always has a passion for that. And he talked about him growing up in Kansas City and how he talked about his father and the work that he did with, I believe, he was an insurance.
That's right.
And how.
Quick draw McGraw.
Yeah. So he talked about his own upbringing and how he felt an obligation to not only solve this story, but also tell the story. And the interesting fact that we, you know, went through boxes and boxes of documents. We actually did some FBI Freedom of Information Act requests, got a bunch of those. Actually got the entire case file from the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, which is 700 pages. And so, you know, coming through that, interviewing folks, talking to people who didn't know that they were suspects in the homicide, talking to former cops, you know, people long gone. I actually talked to a detective, a former police executive named Lloyd DeGraffenry. Just before he died, he was like 93 years old. And I went to his house in Sheridan Estates and talked to him and asked him, you know, actually dug underneath his bed, pulling stuff that he had,
wow.
You know. Yeah, so it was quite fascinating. And then just being there to, you know, while we, you know, we had several things that we had to do, but hearing stories that Mick, you know, would tell about interviewing people or trying to interview people who were connected to the homicide. One guy whose name I'm not going to mention, he went to see him at a auto body or auto repair shop, and then he agreed to talk to Mick. He just got out of prison, federal prison. They were going to meet. So Mick is there. They're getting ready to talk. The guy's lawyer pulls up, screeches into the garage, and calls the interview off. So, and he was part of that Black Mafia type of deal. So it was kind of interesting from the aspect of just learning all these different cast of characters and everything. And it was just a master's thesis class on advanced reporting. And Mick was so accommodating, so unassuming about his role and his place in history and so forth. So I think he felt that the Black community should have recognized what he did. There were some people who did not want us to report that. A lot of people did not want us to dig up the other side of Leon Jordan.
That's what Mick told me, yeah.
People did not want that. And so it was a lot of push and pull and trying to convince a lot of stalwarts in the community that we were undertaking this enormous task. And just seems like, you know, we had parallel investigations with the police department, and lucky enough, ours came out before theirs, came up with the exact same conclusion, and it was quite fascinating. So,
well, when you come to see the play, you will see a line where I acknowledge that I don't. In fact, because Mick is so unassuming, I had your names in the play, and he was like, "No, you got to take them out." So,
yeah, that was him.
That's totally him. Well,
I would love my name to be.
I am so sorry. See, it's all Mick's fault, you know.
Yeah.
Oh man, Glenn, Micah, thank you so much for joining us at the table for three in the Green Duck Lounge today. This was great.
Let's pick it up a tad.
Green Duck Lounge is at MU's Rheinsberger Theater February 21st through 25th. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, the playwright, and I'm hosting these conversations about issues raised in the play as part of our conversation series, Table for Three. You can also join Micah Kubik, Glenn Rice, and myself for more conversation at the production. Learn more at greenduckproject.com.